Our guest today has had an extraordinary career spanning two decades as a UX design pioneer. From their early days working with flash animations and rich web experiences to the leading design teams at startups, tech giants, and agencies, they've consistently pushed the boundaries of what's possible in crafting exceptional digital products. Their work has shaped the experiences of millions across web, mobile, and voice interfaces. And as an industry thought leader, they've mentored countless designers, championed accessibility, and advocated for ethical practices in the age of AI. Currently serving as the head of design operations at the Copenhagen Institute of Interaction Design, our guest is a sought-after educator. With a remarkable legacy of advancing human-centered design and driving innovation, it's my pleasure to welcome Julia Dabari to the Same Logic Podcast. The Same Logic Podcast is brought to you by Same Logic, smart intercept surveys that product teams love. Julia, thanks so much for joining us today on the Same Logic Podcast. For our listeners who may be less familiar with your exceptional career, I'd love for you to briefly introduce yourself and your professional journey so far.
Yeah, great. It's awesome to be here. Thank you for asking me. I really appreciate it. A little bit about me. I got started in the dot-com bubble. Some of you might be a little not familiar with that term. So it was back in Silicon Valley with pop-ups of startups popping up everywhere. And I graduated school, and I know it sounds crazy in this day and age, but I had one interview and was able to get a job, and sort of the rest was history. I worked most of my career in San Francisco, Silicon Valley, and currently I'm in Boston.
Oh, nice. In our previous conversation and everything, we talked about like early information architecture using Flash and everything like that. Walk us through like the different technologies that you've used back in the day and like how it's like helped you form the things that you do today.
So as you said, Flash was really popular back when I came out, and that's what I actually learned a lot in school. I went to school for digital design, and well, I went for a couple things, but I'll just say digital design for now. And Flash was like half my education, and I could program in Flash. I could animate like you would not believe in Flash. It was a tool made by a company called Macromedia that got bought by Adobe. And I bring that up because a little part of my story was I was working at Macromedia at the time that they were getting acquired by Adobe. And so that was really interesting experience as well. But way back then, it was like animation, flashy things were really cool. And I worked at a design studio, that's where my first job was, that built their own, which seems like nothing, but a no code website builder, which seems like nothing nowadays. You're like, oh, we have Squarespace and Webflow. I was doing that in 2000 with Flash, and just seeing, like, looking back how amazing that was is mind-blowing, honestly.
So as a pioneer in information architecture and experience design, what fundamental principles do you think have stood the test of time versus practices that have needed to evolve?
Yeah, that's a really great question. I was just talking to a junior person about this, trying to explain that some things have been around a long time, and that's for valid reasons. It wasn't like we're traditionalists who can't let things go. And one of those, I think, is really understanding scenarios and user flows and how those have evolved. So user flows are boxes and arrows, and understanding how screens interact and how the user will move through those screens before you know what's going on. But what's evolved is wire flows and screen flows. And I think what happens a lot in our industry now is that people conflate those terms and sort of mix and match them together, and it loses the importance of the user flows. And in information architecture and user experience, user flows are key to understand a proper user experience.
So when it comes on to some of the biggest innovations that are still required in UX research methods, what do you think are the key things that are still true today that were true 10 years ago, 20 years ago?
Yeah, I think that's actually a really good question, because there was a book that got published 10 years ago called Interviewing Users by Steve Portigal, and he was very resistant to writing an update. And then he was like, it's been 10 years. Okay, I think it's ready for second edition. And I couldn't believe it was 2014 because I actually interviewed him when he wrote his book when it first came out in 2014. And I think that some of the things are still really key in listening, understanding how to ask proper open-ended questions and not leaving the user in interviews are still some of the things that people really need to practice and understand. And then, there's innovative things we've done. There was a question that in user research that we all use for a long time that's evolved. And that question is, if I had a magic wand, how would I change this experience for you? And that's so broad that we've now made it something more specific is how would you like me to change the functionality, or how would you like me to change your feelings about this experience? And we use different noun verbs to get more articulate answers from people. And that's the final question you usually ask in a user interview. And I think that's something that's really amazing in our industry that, it's a small thing, but it's really interesting to see how it's something like that has changed our industry over the last 10 years.
When it comes on to like omni-channel design as well, what are some of the biggest barriers like still needed to be solved when designing for true omni-channel experiences across web, mobile, voice, and probably IoT?
Yeah. We have the answer in our toolbox, but we just don't use it. So it's called service design blueprints. And these are how all those different channels interact or don't, and the support systems they need to work. And almost every company I've worked at takes each of those experiences, such as, mobile and web and hardware, are all separate teams that don't talk to each other. And so we call it as a user an omni-channel experience, but the processes to build those are not omni-channel, which is how they should be. And a service blueprint would help show those barriers and how to overcome them. And it's a tool that we already have as user experience designers in our toolbox. It's just not used enough.
Well, what promising directions do you see at the intersection of UX design and behavioral science, especially when it comes down to nudging and habit formation?
Yeah, there's a resource that I like to use a lot called the Cog Load Cookbook. I don't know why I said it. And I think one thing is they do teardowns of different experiences and use the behavioral science behind it of why it works or doesn't work and then how to improve that. And I think we need more people understanding the behavioral science of how things work. So, like a really simple example is pricing pages. We've all seen a million pricing pages on the internet for every service. Behavioral science says you should put the most expensive thing to the left for Western readers and the least expensive to the right. And then that'll nudge someone to buy the middle price because they'll be like, oh my God, I don't want to pay that super expensive one. And then so they focus on that middle one. But how many pricing pages have you seen where that's exact opposite, where the cheapest is on the left and the most expensive is on the right? And it's like we're just missing this really simple behavioral science nudge that says people buy the middle price.
Wow, I love that. Yes, I was thinking about our pricing page. That's exactly how it is. Like the cheapest is on the left, the most expensive on the right. We'll change that. Amazing. As more industries undergo digital transformation, what are some best practices that you've seen introducing UX culture and advocacy top down in organizations?
Yeah, it's funny. This is actually sort of in a high level a debate in our industry right now. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the term design maturity. And so there was a book that came out, actually, I think it was 2016, called Org Design for Design Orgs, all around this like top-down or bottom-up influence of design and how is the best way to do it throughout an organization. And a lot of people read that book and said, like, well, here's a model, we should follow this model. And if your company doesn't follow this model, then we're not a design-led company. But really, there's a really important chapter in that book, chapter three, and it's like the 12 qualities, sorry, qualities of a design org. And you really have to meet each company where it's at. I mean, how many companies, I don't know, have you worked at where it's like, oh, we work exactly the same as this last company you worked at? That's not true. No company is exactly the same. So you can't have one simplistic linear model of how to be a design organization. And I think there's no way to take that and replicate it across companies because not all companies work exactly the same.
Speaking about advocacy as well, what are gaps that you still see in addressing accessibility and inclusive design across the industry? And how do you think we can drive more progress there?
Yeah, I for a long time, and I saw this, there's a I, well, no, I saw this thing on TikTok, and it was just this little snippet, and it was like, we all thought the problem with education is not enough people had access to it, but now we have the internet and we still have people who are, not fully educated. So like it wasn't just access. And I think it's sort of the same thing with inclusivity and accessibility, and that like people know we need to do that. And it's tons of information online. You can do that. You can build your digital presence to be as accessible as possible. But I think a lot of it comes down to business and like how much money do businesses want to pay for that. And so if you're in an user experience type of role, is really learning how to persuade your business partners, such as product and engineering, to include that into the development timeline. And there's some things you can do as a user experience designer where you don't even have to ask, you can just do it. And then it's not that expensive and just build it into the timeline without asking. I don't mean to advocate like don't share knowledge or be not transparent, but some things aren't that hard, like color contrast. Like just do that as a designer, and then engineers will work with you and build it the way you should build it. That's a really simple thing, and I think more companies and sites should, take advantage of their ability to do some accessibility and inclusivity work for very little effort.
What emerging jobs and specialties do you foresee? Do you foresee being critical in the future of UX design? And with everything happening, the industry is changing so rapidly. What skills do you think will be in demand most?
Yeah, it's funny. I would loop that back to UX research that we were talking about in the beginning. I think really knowing your UX research skills, because I don't think a AI can replace that anytime soon, where AI is going to help with streamlining processes. So another skill of prompt engineering. And then also really understanding back to your just previous question of not sharing any personal identification information with AI. And so learning where those ethics and lines are to not cross and how to do that responsibly, I think is really key. And once again, I don't think this can be this huge effort that we all need to sit down and like study for 1,000 hours on how to do like this. I think these things are small steps that we can all do in a reasonable amount of time and make our work better.
I love that. When it comes on to the industry, the UX industry, like it, with the mainstreaming of the UX industry, what core principles and or best practices are at risk at being diluted or misapplied?
Yeah, I'll go back to user flows again just because I see it in every portfolio. Like, I've only seen one correct user flow in the last 8 months, looking at hundreds of portfolios. One in 8 months. And these are people, masters, PhDs, bachelor's, boot camp. And I'm just like, what is going on? Like, who is teaching these kids these things? And to your point about dilution, what's happening is people are mixing wire flows and screen flows and user flows into all one thing. And I know these are very specific deliverables and hard to explain on a podcast, but it's really important to get those right. And also back to what I was talking about earlier with service blueprints. If we could all do service blueprints, and once again, there's tons of resources online. So it's not like this is some gated information that you can't get to. You get to it for free. I think we can all make better experiences. And I'm worried we're getting too templatized in our industry. Like, oh, here's a Figma template. Here's a Webflow template, here's whatever, and we'll just copy that and put our information in there. And I just worry that's diluting some of our industry, or maybe there'll be some people that are really like avant-garde, and some people are like, I'm just going to follow this template. And we might have a schism coming up soon. Or did I say that right? Schism? Between like the template followers and the like total avant-garde people.
I love that because yeah, especially we see the same thing happening across the board when it comes on to like engineering as well. Like everyone is using a framework or a template, and like if a bad practice is in the framework or the template, it's just gonna propagate itself. So yeah, like it's we gotta like make sure it's all properly managed. What innovations at the intersection of UX design and computer science excite you most when it comes on to enhancing designer capabilities?
Yeah, that's a really interesting way of putting it, because I think like most people just jump in and be like, oh, AI is gonna like do everything. And I don't think that's actually it. I think that it's more, I think I'm not gonna get this quote quite right, but Steve Jobs had some quote that like everyone should learn some computer science like in high school or something, because it's a way of thinking. And I think that's really key. And to me, that's what it is, that intersection of like computer science and UX. I'm not in UX because I'm some person who's really good at artistic things. There's a certain way of problem solving from a UX standpoint, and there's another way of problem solving in computer science. And we need to marry those two together, I think, is what's really happening with the intersection.
I think this kind of dovetails into my next question as well. Like, what are some of the biggest unsolved challenges you think that appear when you try to balance design consistency versus making it bespoke for diverse user needs or contexts?
Yeah, I think some of the things that really happen is, and this like very organizational thing, it's like UX is on one side, engineering is on another side, products on a third side. They wanted us to be three-legged stools for a while, and instead we're like all separate stools trying to fit together under the table. And I think that's really, design consistency is something that's close to my heart. And to your point earlier, there's all these frameworks that engineers use. And so it's like, well, your consistency on design has to match my framework for my developers. And then the product is like, I don't really care, just get it out there so that my customers can use it. And really bringing us all together so that we understand each other's point of view and how we can work together, which I know sounds a little trite. But I really think that that's something we still haven't learned as well, or some people have and some people haven't. It's enough that there's stereotypes still exist. How about that? And once that stereotype goes away, that we're all fighting for our own little team, then I think we'll have made some progress.
Yes. Also, like when you think about the industry, there has been like a significant push, especially last year, to really quantify and measure the ROI of UX. Do you think over the last couple of years that we've lost appreciation for more like intrinsic and qualitative aspects of design? Or is it the other? Like how do you think about what's happening? What do you think about what's happening in the industry currently?
Yeah, I actually find that really interesting. Like, I agree we need to work closely with the business side. I had a boss who said something really simple once: without the business, you don't have a job. You may fight against like, oh, I don't want to show business metrics, or I don't want to work with the business side. If there's no business, you don't have a job. He's like, stop complaining. but it was, a simple phrase that really stuck with me. And sort of back to my last point is like, we're not fighting. It's not like UX versus business, or it shouldn't be. We should work together. We're supporting each other. I think one thing that UX has trouble with, and it's not just UX, but I'll use it as an example because that's why you're talking to me, is the idea of growth at any cost and the whole rampant capitalism that we have here in America at a lot of companies, especially Silicon Valley and tech companies, like grow, grow, grow. And I think that's where we hesitate, and we're seen as like, well, you're not supporting the business, you're not working with the business because you don't want to like grow at any costs. But we focus on the users that we already have and not just the new users. And I think there's a disconnect between like always getting new users and supporting existing users. And I think the business side, which I really need to think about, like your existing customers as well, and it's not just all about new customers.
What emerging ethical dilemmas and consequences related to UX design should we be more cautious and perhaps more thoughtful about?
Yeah, I mean, I would say a little bit the growth at any cost thing is important in that respect too. Especially, there's been a prevalence lately of growth design, which is really focusing on new users and not looking at existing users. And so, if we're going to have these growth designers, we need to have some designers focusing on your existing customers. I don't know what that term is. We already have so many titles in our industry. I don't know if we need another one. But if we're going to call that out, I think that's something to be concerned about from an ethical standpoint is. And then how long is that user considered new for? You know, you have a new user, they sign up, they buy your product or service. Are they no longer new? Is it like, okay, we got them in the door, are we done? I think that's an ethical consideration that, you know, here in America, we really need to focus on.
And what lessons have you learned from your time in UX that were most like formative in shaping your perspectives and philosophies as a designer?
Yeah, it's funny because I am old school. I didn't do a good job there in the beginning answering your question. I just like got a little like, ah. But I really like in the dot-com bubble, I worked at a company that had like 60 people and I went through a whole layoff within just a few months. And then I was brought back right after the layoff. So that was an interesting, but I learned that no one's going to watch out for my career but me. And it took me a while to put that into practice, but it was definitely a hard learned lesson very young in my life. And I think that that's something that more designers need to think about as well.
I love that. So, Julia, we're going to play a game here
Okay.
of like 10 this or that questions. They're all rapid fire questions. So, pretty much this or that. All right. So, ready? All
Ready.
right, let's go. Early bird or night owl when working?
Early bird.
Awesome. Messy desk or everything in its place?
Everything in this place.
Coffee or tea while ideating?
Tea.
Pencils or pens for sketching?
Pens.
Mac or PC for design work?
Mac.
For sure. Loud music or total quiet when heads down designing?
Total quiet.
Cats or dogs as office companions?
Cats.
Comfy clothes or business casual and working?
Oh, total comfy clothes.
Same here. Nature hikes or big city exploring to spark ideas?
Ah, that's a tough one for me. I'm gonna go with nature hikes.
And number 10, window seat or aisle seat when traveling?
Window seat.
Awesome. I love that. This is my last question here. I ask everyone who comes on the show, and the question is, what's one weakness that you've turned into your strength?
Yeah, I was really excited for this question because it's really into a book, and it took me reading that book to be able to answer the question. But being quiet and able to listen, I know that like being okay with silence is, you know, and being okay with pauses and quiet. I've always been fine with that, but realizing that that's a strength and not a weakness, and it took me reading someone else's book talking about that. The book is actually called Quiet and it's about introverts. Made me realize that's a strength and not a weakness.
Oh, wow. I love that. Julia, thank you. Thank you so much for joining us today on the Same Object Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I loved the little game. I loved all your questions. They were really insightful, and I hope I answered them well.